It's August 1st, 2003. I'm Andy Mushin, sitting with Mort. Do you pronounce it Cyprus?
Cyprus.
Cyprus. Yes. Mm-hmm. In his home in Eau Claire. And Mort, I didn't ask. Are you a retired professor?
Yes. Yes, I retired 3 years ago, professor of political science.
At the University of Wisconsin.
Eau Claire.
Right. Okay. Well, why don't you tell us how you got to Eau Claire and what you knew about the community first?
Okay. Well, I didn't know much about the community when I first got here. I was in graduate school had finished my coursework and was working on dissertation, which incidentally never got done for what reasons, which will be obvious in a few minutes. I was interviewing for jobs. Mm-hmm. And I was interviewing especially in Chicago at the Midwest Political Science meeting, and because that was the slave market back in the 60s.
I see. Where were you studying at the time?
At the University of Minnesota for my graduate work. I did my college work at City College in New York.
Mm-hmm. And you're a native New Yorker?
I'm a native New Yorker, yes. And when I came out to Minneapolis for graduate school, I thought it would be nice to see another part of the country, and then go back to civilization. And when I came to Eau Claire, I assumed it would be a sort of a stepping stone. Usually your first job is not your last job. Mm-hmm. And so I didn't have any expectations of staying here. But I got through the interview in Chicago successfully, and I was then invited out to meet the rest of the department. And Sylvia, incidentally, was on that committee in Chicago as well as here in Eau Claire that was doing a lot of the interviewing.
I see. And Sylvia, of course, is your wife.
We didn't know each other at the time. Every indication was that perhaps we should know each other, but we didn't at the time. And mm-hmm. so I was out for the interviews, and I got the job here. And I was pleased to be reasonably close to the Twin Cities, because that's where my advisor was, and the Twin Cities are a wonderful place.
Yes.
And so being first in Minneapolis and then coming here was an easy move, and I stayed. Hmm. and I'm still here, although I'm retired now. Retired mm-hmm. in 2000.
Right. Now, you were telling me that when you came to Eau Claire, you were single.
That's right. And that night of the interview here in Eau Claire, Sylvia and I were sitting next to each other in the restaurant that the department took me to, and we started talking almost immediately like we were old friends. We had much in common. Turned out Sylvia was from Brooklyn, as I was from Brooklyn, and we had similar backgrounds. And so it was easy to just start up conversation and just have a good time talking at that moment. A colleague's wife was observing us, and without our knowing it, and without even knowing whether I was going to take the job, I hadn't said so yet, she bet three other people in the department that we'd be engaged by the end of the year. We found out she did this when we got engaged before the end of the academic year. And she was collecting from the other people in the department.
Boy, that's wonderful.
The one additional humorous thing about the way we met is that a few months after, when we were making up our wedding list, we found out we had mutual friends in New York.
Oh, my.
And I had gone to college I hadn't gone to the same college, but I got to know while in college a very good friend of hers. A guy who also lived in Brooklyn, and I got to know at City College a girl who was a very fine, very close friend of Sylvia's. Hmm. We were never introduced, mm-hmm. and in part it would have been impossible for us to develop anything in New York. It would have taken me about 2 to 3 hours to get to her house on three different subway trains, just staying in Brooklyn. It just wasn't the way to go out on a date. Mm-hmm. So it never would have happened there. But it was just amazing that we mm-hmm. had these mutual friends who never even tried to introduce us. I'm sure they weren't even thinking of the two of us in the same at the same time.
Sure.
And so it was left mm-hmm. for the wedding to to bring the old friends together as well, as it turned out.
Mm-hmm. How much earlier did your wife arrive in Eau Claire than you?
Well, she came via Madison. She went to Brooklyn College in New York, and then went to the University of Wisconsin at Madison for graduate work, and that's where she got her degree. And she was hired here in 1964.
Mm-hmm.
And after 1 year in North Dakota, which was not the greatest place to be teaching. She taught in one of the ag school buildings and had to get, shoo the cats and cows out. But after 1 year there in a temporary job, she got the job here at Eau Claire. And she wasn't going to stay too long. The year I came may have been her last or next year, last year, as she was thinking. Because it wasn't much of a place for a single woman, a single Jewish woman, especially. But then I came along. We fell in love. We married, and we've been here ever since. I came in 1966.
I see.
She wound up teaching at the university here for 35 years before retiring. 34 years before retiring. And we've just been here and been active in the community. I've been especially active in the Jewish community as well as other things.
Mm-hmm.
She's been active in a lot of social service types of stuff. We finally became a part of the community. It took a few years for everybody to accept us, not in the congregation. The Jewish congregation here was very friendly right from the start.
Mm-hmm.
They even put something together when we got engaged. It was a very, very nice community, and they got you involved very quickly. It didn't take very long before I became a vice president.
Mm-hmm.
Was
that, do you think?
I became vice president back in about 1969.
Oh, within three years. Vice president.
The president at that time dropped the bombshell that he was leaving Eau Claire.
Mm.
He had taken over his father's business, a dress and bride and gown shop, a very successful business.
Mm-hmm.
But the president and his wife decided they wanted to live in Florida. I don't think Florida is worth moving to, but
a lot of Jews do.
A lot of Jews do, and they tragically wound up getting divorced down there.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not sure it was such a good move for them, but it was not a good move for the congregation, because Jeff Marcus was not only the president, he was the congregation's only shofar blower.
Oh boy.
So before leaving, he said he would teach me and another person, Irv Marin's son, I think it's David Marin, how to play the shofar. Now, for Jeff, it was relatively easy because he was a trumpeter.
Oh, sure.
A very good one, in fact. Mm-hmm. And the Marin boy was a pretty good trumpeter. I had experience only with a saxophone. Mm-hmm. And that's not preparation for a shofar.
That's right.
So Jeff taught us how to do it. But David stayed around only for about another year. He went off to college, and that was about the last we really saw of him in the community.
Default?
I became the only shofar blower.
Uh-huh.
And I guess I became pretty good. I've never done it quite to my satisfaction, but I think I get a little better each year.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it just takes a lot of practice and a lot of getting that lip in shape. It doesn't take that much wind, as a lot of people think.
Mm-hmm.
But I've been doing it, and I guess confidently. I'm not the only one anymore. I taught a young lady how to blow it last year. Occasionally there have been some others in the community who could do it, but who then left.
Mm-hmm.
So last year we shared the shofar blowing. This young lady was about 14 or 15 at the time. I'm hoping she'll be willing to do it again this year, and we'll split the time, because I think it's healthy for the community to have more than one.
Absolutely.
One of the things I've done, which the congregation has liked very much, my wife bought me for Hanukkah 1 year, one of the big shofars.
With the curl in it?
Yeah. It's, I forget, an African country that it comes out of. That is saying, I'll think of it eventually on it. And that has just a beautiful mellow tone.
Mm.
And it just rings out, and it's a small synagogue, as you'll see later.
Mm-hmm.
It just rings out in that place, no matter how many people are there, and they're not very many that most of the time.
Mm-hmm.
And I've enjoyed doing it, so I just have kept on doing it.
Well, that's wonderful. Let me ask you about the congregation in the days when you arrived.
Mm-hmm.
You said they were very welcoming to you.
Yes.
excuse me. Were they in the current building that they are now?
Yes.
Okay.
The congregation moved into the building before I came. They dedicated it in 1960. I think the actual purchase was made in late 59.
Mm-hmm.
It was dedicated in 60 and became the home of the area Jewish community. From that point on, the community had moved in a sense with where the population was. It was in Menominee sometimes, it was in Chippewa Falls sometimes, and we've had people come down to the congregation from as far away as Rice Lake, which is 60 miles north. But we finally got a home of our own. Some serious fundraising took place prior to 1960, and they raised enough money to buy what had been a Wesleyan church. There was an interesting contact with them later on. So we moved into the building and started using it for services in 1960.
Mm-hmm.
Now, at that time, the congregation had access to a couple of rabbis. One was Orthodox, which you might call modern Orthodox, but too Orthodox for the congregation.
Mm-hmm.
This congregation's people were mainly either Reform or Conservative.
I see.
Very few would identify themselves as Orthodox. And I myself lean more Conservative, even though I was raised Orthodox.
Mm-hmm.
Rabbi Eisman was his name. He
could you spell that?
Eisenman, I think, is the right spelling.
Oh, like Eisenman?
Meyer Eisenman, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And where was he from?
He was from Twin Cities.
Mm-hmm.
And he was the head of one of the Talmud Torahs there. And one of his reasons for liking to come to Eau Claire is some people here were of wealth, and he could raise money for his Talmud Torah from them. But he was also a very, very good scholar, very nice guy. So he was always welcomed when he came out for a visit.
How often was he here?
He'd come out a couple, three, four times a year.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes
for Shabbat or
no, not for Shabbat. We usually would be weekdays, and he'd be back home before Shabbat would start. As far as I know, he never conducted a service, with perhaps one semi exception. We asked him if he would preside over our son's bris.
Mm.
Neil and Matt were twins. They were born in September 6th in 1969, they were adopted. We adopted them at 10 weeks old, and it was pretty rare to get any Jewish adoption. They were of a Jewish mother, and it was pretty rare to get a child for adoption who had a Jewish mother. In this case, they were twins, which was even more rare. So we adopted them later in 1969, 10 weeks after the September 6th birth date. They did get circumcised where they were born, but we're not at all sure, and the kids wouldn't know, of course, whether they had a regular bris or not. We decided we would have one. Since they were circumcised, there was still a little bit of a procedure they could do, and we asked Rabbi Eisman to. Did I say Eisman? That N should not be there.
Oh, E I S E M A N.
Yeah, that's closer to it. I can double check the spelling when we go back downstairs.
Okay.
I have the boys' baby books, and that's got some of that information in it.
So did you have a moil then, too?
Or? Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Shepsel Roberts was the moil.
And where is he from?
From Minneapolis also. And he was a certified real moil. He was not a physician, but he knew a hell of a lot more than most physicians.
That's true,
about
they do.
About the procedure, and he did the remainder of the circumcision.
Mm-hmm.
And in that, there's just a little extra prick. where the cover was removed. And boys were still unhappy.
Of course. And who can blame them?
But Chepsel was really, he was quite a fun guy. Also a very good personality. And he'd explain everything he's doing as he's going along. And he had a good sense of humor.
Was he here often? I mean, were there many Brits?
Whenever there was a Brit, he was the one they called.
Well, what was the congregation like in those days? How many people? Were there kids?
There were probably about 40 households in the congregation in those days. And when I came, it was sort of at the tail end of the younger kids. There would not be too many younger kids for quite a while after that point. And the kids getting towards college age would usually go off to college somewhere else than here. Although I think in many cases they would have gotten a better education at Eau Claire simply because of the size of the school and the way they had contact with faculty. And that was one of the very attractive things about Eau Claire. At Madison, of course, half your courses are taught by TAs. But that's where
most of lectures with hundreds of people.
Yeah.
That's what I remember.
And you had the TAs for probably a discussion group
that's
of some
exactly
sort.
That's exactly right.
Yeah. I was never enamored of that system. But Madison, of course, has the reputation. The reputation really comes out of its graduate program, and that does filter down to some extent to the undergraduate program. And that's where the Jewish kids would go, at least most of them. Some of them went out of state altogether, and they really would never move back here. They usually will have met spouses elsewhere, and the job opportunities weren't great here. When I came, more of the members were involved in some aspect of business than anything else.
Were they merchants? Or
some of them were merchants, yes. We also had National Presto Industries here, which was a Jewish and still is a Jewish-owned firm in terms of who has the controlling stock.
Right.
And that a number of other Jewish people were employed by Presto. And so they constituted a part of an important part of the community when I came. I'm not sure we could have survived financially without some of the kinds of supports we got from the people connected with Presto.
Now, the Phillips family, I know, is very generous in all aspects in Eau Claire. So you're speaking of them and others?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. The one place where the congregation, each family chipped in, I guess, an equal amount, was in the purchasing of the building. I probably wouldn't have done it this way, but the congregation agreed to do it with equal contributions of $1,000 each at that time. And they raised enough to be able to do it. There were some who simply couldn't afford it and didn't. There were some who couldn't afford it and resented the pressure that was implied by the arrangement. The Phillips family and some others felt that everybody should have an equal investment. And, I just think that you can have an equal investment with people doing what they can afford rather than the flat amount. That all happened before I came.
I see.
So I wasn't yet a noisemaker here. The community was largely businessmen, but the businesses started selling out or people retiring and just leaving. The shops couldn't be maintained very well anymore. One guy owned a men's shop up in Chippewa Falls, which is 12 miles north. And it was a very good men's shop. He eventually moved it down to Eau Claire, and it was still a very good men's shop, and they did pretty good business, but people were not buying suits as much. And, of course, by now, Eau Claire has just a couple of total men's shops. You have the department stores, but there are only two that I know of that are devoted to men's clothing.
And what's the name of this gentleman you're referring
to? He was Ray Andersky. He's buried in our cemetery, in fact.
And what was the name of his store?
The Boston store.
The Boston store,
And he had some trouble at first legally with the Boston store in Milwaukee, I guess it was. in terms of who was entitled to that name, and he wound up just calling it the Boston.
Mm-hmm.
And it survived as a successful business. The Marcuses, I had mentioned Jeff in the show for blowing, the Marcuses owned a very popular women's shop, which included an important bridal section, and an awful lot of the women who got married back in those days, back in the 50s and 60s, got their wedding gowns, including my wife, mm-hmm. at the Marcuses shop.
And what was that called?
Let's see, what was Jeff's father's name? I'll have to think about
okay.
that a little bit. Doesn't pay to think on tape, but mm-hmm. I will...
Okay, you can let me.
I'll let you know, yeah. Yeah, it'll come.
Mm-hmm. So the 40 families, approximately, the 40 households back in the mid-60s, did most of them live in Eau Claire and then some in the surrounding communities?
More lived in Eau Claire, mm-hmm. and then a majority, in fact, did live in Eau Claire, mm-hmm. and then the next largest grouping of Jews then was around the Menominee area,
mm-hmm.
which is the center of Menominee, 25 miles west. Some of them were even more scattered from that. A couple of people in Whitehall, Wisconsin,
mm-hmm.
There were some other small towns that people were from. We still have one good member from and his wife both from Spring Valley.
Spring Valley.
Yeah, which is still further east than Menominee, and we have one member from Stillwater, who didn't like the big city synagogues in Minnesota that were nearby in, mm-hmm. in the Twin Cities. And so they attached themselves to our congregation, which is a longer drive, but mm-hmm. More to their liking.
Mm-hmm.
And but that's more recent. In those days, it was Menominee was the second largest place. There was some in Chippewa Falls, some in Rice Lake.
Mm-hmm. And were they these other Jewish families, were they mostly merchants in these smaller towns? Because that's been the pattern.
Either that or a couple of them were, for example, optometrists,
mm-hmm.
Which I guess you can say they were merchants in a sense, mm-hmm. but of a different professional
right,
calling.
Right,
and most of them were either merchants or worked for businesses.
Mm-hmm.
They may have been working for Presto.
Mm-hmm.
There were several active members of the congregation who worked for Presto.
I see.
But otherwise, the other Phillips family, the L.L. Phillips family, they were cousins of the L.E. Phillips family.
Mm-hmm.
They used to call L.L. Little Louie and L.E. Big Louie. They didn't seem to mind it. I probably would have.
I wouldn't like to be Little Louie.
No.
Right.
But he was also a very generous guy, mm-hmm. and helpful with the congregation. We need to always mean to make a public appreciation announcement when we get a gift for something in the congregation, but Little Louie was not expecting to be a public person as a result of it.
I see.
He was pretty private.
Mm-hmm.
And so nobody was naming buildings, for example, after him, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Big Louie accepted those kinds of honors.
Mm-hmm.
And that was perhaps one of the distinguishing points between the two.
Mm-hmm.
They were, in fact, both very, very generous and supportive of the congregation, and helped the congregation to survive mm-hmm. its more difficult times.
Now, just quickly, Big Louie, who was L.E., he was the founder of Presto Industries.
He was either the founder or he bought it.
I don't
know which.
Okay, and then Little Louie, L.L., what did he do?
He was in the scrap business, mm-hmm. in the plastics business, and those were the two major things that he built his fortune with.
Mm-hmm.
And now his son has ownership of the business.
I see.
And his son's an amazing person, actually. He has cerebral palsy, extremely bright, but his ability to use his hands and to speak are much more difficult for him. Yet he developed a mastery of the business and is able to very successfully run it.
That's great.
And, he doesn't come to the synagogue very often. His father didn't either. even though they were very supportive. But I always see him there on the high holidays, and somebody who for many years has been helping him to get around, to drive mm-hmm. him and help get up steps and the like.
I see.
So that's been an interesting part of the Jewish mm-hmm. community here, too.
You mentioned that back in your early days with the congregation, there were two rabbis. Now, one was Eisman, and then who was the other?
The other was the more semi-official, you might say, was Lou Milgram mm-hmm. From Minneapolis. He was the head of Hillel, the rabbi at Hillel at the University of Minnesota.
I see.
I had actually gotten to know him a little bit there and had some interaction with him at that when I was in graduate school. He came out and did the dedication for the synagogue, and he also started coming out regularly for the high holidays and occasionally for some other things.
Mm-hmm.
There was a small period of time where he came out monthly for a Friday night service, and that just didn't work out very well at that time. He was very good in relating to the businessmen in the community,
mm-hmm.
And they liked him very much, and he was of the Reform persuasion. But age took its toll over time, and I think he's still alive, actually, but the trip to Eau Claire was just too much for him to do, even just for the holidays.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, I remember one time he collapsed right on the bima.
Oh, my goodness.
And I wound up finishing the Yom Kippur service, in fact,
mm-hmm.
Even though I can't sing. Mm-hmm. And I sing in the key of off. But I more or less knew from him what he did,
mm-hmm.
as I was a close observer of him from the time I came.
What happened to him when he collapsed?
It must have been just exhaustion. His heart was fine. We got him over to the hospital here, and they really couldn't find anything, and he drove home. Even though it was Yom Kippur, we persuaded him to drive home that afternoon, not try to drive at night after the shofar is blown.
Mm-hmm.
And he had to live up to what he always preached, that you fast and you do other things of observance unless it endangers your health.
Mm-hmm.
And we persuaded him that he is better off being close to where his doctors are and his wife, and he took that advice and did mm-hmm. go home.
Do you remember what year this was, approximately?
It would have been in the early 70s,
mm-hmm.
72, 73, someplace around mm-hmm. there.
So back in those earlier days, the late 60s, early 70s, how often did the congregation meet for services?
Monthly.
Monthly.
We had services monthly, and lay people conducted the services.
Mm-hmm.
There were a group
Including
of us.
You?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
There were a group of us who more or less shared the conducting.
Were these Friday night or Saturday
They were
morning?
Friday night, uh-huh. yeah.
Did you ever read Torah?
We didn't have a Torah reader.
Mm-hmm.
At that time, so if there were a special occasion like a bar mitzvah and people would bring in a rabbi, we'd have a Torah reading then, of course.
Mm-hmm.
We always had it on the high holidays because we always had a rabbi on the high holidays.
Mm-hmm. So did this congregation ever have a full-time rabbi?
No.
And the issue was finances?
The issue was in part finances. The issue was also the thought that what rabbi would come to preside over a changing in population that was losing its numbers,
mm-hmm.
it wasn't the center of Jewish scholarship. And that's a deterrent to a rabbi. He likes to be around other rabbis
mm-hmm.
just for the intellectual interchange. And we could not provide that. So that and money contributed to not really struggling more to get a rabbi to come out every mm-hmm. year for the holidays, and we did. After Lou Milgram couldn't do it anymore, Jonathan Paradise became, and he's not a rabbi, he was a teacher. In fact, he taught Hebrew studies at the University of Minnesota.
Mm-hmm.
But he had a good singing voice, and he knew how to read Torah, and his wife could help him with that too. She
mm-hmm.
she always stood there alongside to do the corrections. Jonathan was bright and able, and he did this for a number of years, and then I'm trying to place the more or less the right year. It would have been around the late 80s. So Yossi's been here 12 years now. So it would have been around 12 years ago, which would be 1991, actually. New people had come into the congregation from elsewhere, people with families. There was a period of growth. I thought I was presiding over a dying congregation. Yeah, for
what
years
were you president? I forgot to ask you.
With a 2-year hiatus in there, I was president from about 1971 through 1993.
Oh my goodness!
But there was a 2-year hiatus in there, so it wasn't 20 years, but it was about 17 years, With 2 years in there, somebody else, Ray Amdursky, in fact, was president. It turned out that being an organization running person wasn't his style. He took it on out of a sense of obligation, but he had some difficulty managing, in a sense. He could manage his business very well, but running a congregation is another story.
Yes, that is true.
So I came back in, and even when I would threaten to resign and reach my deadline for resigning, they still wouldn't elect anybody else. And the congregation was losing numbers. People weren't moving in.
So by 19, what year was the low number, do you think?
It would have been in the mid-80s would have been the low number.
And what was that number?
We were down to just below 30 households.
So you went from around 40 to just below 30. And,
yeah.
And what was the reason for the decline in membership?
Well, some of it had to do with age, where children did not stay in the community and the parents and grandparents passed away. Others moved and left for warmer climates. So it was just sort of an attrition in the community. It wasn't people unhappy here who suddenly decided to leave, but rather more an attrition type of thing.
And then what changed that?
Well, some of it started changing with a little more hiring at the University of Jewish people. Jewish people ordinarily were not attracted to the university in Eau Claire because it seemed isolated with not much of a Jewish life there. But that started changing. But it wasn't just university people. Some physicians started moving in. And these were young physicians. Many of them would prove not to be permanent residents here, but some of them did become that. And they began bringing our numbers up between the physicians and the university faculty, and then a few other kinds of professionals. We started picking up our numbers to what it is now, about 35 families. And that's about as big as we are, and so our synagogue is only occasionally filled. It gets filled, almost filled on some parts of the high holidays, and it gets filled for things like bar mitzvahs, where people will invite not just the congregation and their families, who may come from some distance, but a lot of the other non-Jewish people in the community who are friends of the family get invited. And we've had bar mitzvahs that have us pushing the walls out because of the number of guests who are invited.
So on the High Holy Days, how many Jews may then be in the congregation? Maybe sitting in the synagogue.
Okay. I would say we average out in the best times, like for Kol Nidre and the first night of Rosh Hashanah, we average out about 50 or 60 people in the synagogue, which can comfortably seat 120. And that's about as well as we can do within just the community, the Jewish community.
But then you're saying for a bar about mitzvah, you'll get more than you'll get 120 or more.
Yes.
Because of non-Jewish guests.
Yeah, there was a time even I couldn't get a seat in there because I arrived a little late. because non-Jewish people were invited in addition. The whole congregation is usually invited to any bar mitzvah or bat mitzvah in the synagogue.
What did the congregation do for religious school, for educating the children?
We usually, in those days, hired a young person, maybe you'd be a university student or or in some other way a student or a young professional, to come out and teach on Sundays.
So is this somebody from the Twin Cities who would drive over?
Yeah, he would drive over Sunday morning and stay into the early afternoon, meeting in classes with different ages, and sometimes an age may only have two kids in it, an age bracket. But that's where training was taking place, just to a limited extent, very limited extent.
So what did the kids learn?
Not much. a little bit of history. A little bit of arts and crafts kinds of stuff were done. And it was not effective Jewish education.
Could they read Hebrew? Did they learn to read Hebrew?
Some of them.
But the attempt was made to teach them.
A little bit of an attempt was made, yes. Yes. And lay people did a lot of the teaching also, always to supplement. And when we couldn't get somebody from the Twin Cities, lay people especially were critical. You know, members of the congregation take.
Did you ever teach?
I once taught an adult group how to read Hebrew.
I see.
A lot of people did not know how to even read Hebrew, and, and I didn't know that much Hebrew. And I still don't know it as a language. But I had drummed into me in Talmud Torah in New York how to read.
Right, decoding in a sense, I think is the term.
Well, yeah, maybe
I mean,
that's, so.
That's how I read, too.
Yeah.
I know the letters.
Yeah, yeah. I guess decoding is a good word for that. I hadn't heard it before. But I taught a group. Many of them are, well, not many of them left anymore. A few were still here in the congregation, still alive. And that was a useful thing. They felt much more comfortable. Even though they couldn't translate it, but we always had we had a conservative affiliation, and we always had the English translation and alongside the Hebrew. So it made it much more comfortable for those people who took those Hebrew lessons. I'm only sorry I couldn't go further with it. Then in the early 1980s, an Israeli couple moved here. And he was a mathematician. His wife was a leading civil engineer, water engineer in Israel, and he was teaching math in Israel. And Beersheba is where they were living, and it's their parents who migrated to Israel earlier on. He didn't have too much of a professional future. But he wasn't interested in doing the high-level theoretical mathematical research. And the Israeli universities are modeled after the most research-oriented American universities. And he preferred a more applied type of math. His dissertation, which was fascinating, was on the relationship between mathematics and Hebrew. There were all kinds of relationships that he could find.
That is interesting.
Yeah, but it wasn't something that enthused the academic community in Israel. So he came to the United States, and at that time, and I think it's still true to a certain extent, in order to get anywhere in Israel in academia, you have to spend time in the United States. I got one friend who's in sociology at the Technion, of all places, in Haifa. He comes here every few years to do some professional work because it's kind of expected of the academic community in Israel, at least in some of the universities.
I see.
And so Eli Maor and Dalia Maor settled here for about 8 years.
8 years.
Yeah, and she did a lot of the teaching. She did a lot of the bar mitzvah training. Alternative, some of us would take our kids to the cities for bar mitzvah training. I took Neil, who was especially adept at being able to learn these things, once a month to the Talmud Torah and the Talmud Torah of Minneapolis. And the teacher there made tapes, and Neil could work from the tapes here and then meet with him once a month to get things straightened out and to keep moving along with it. And so Neil had a very, very traditional type of bar mitzvah. Our son Matt, his twin brother, had some learning disabilities, and the learning of Hebrew was extremely difficult for him. And the a monthly trip into the cities wouldn't have been very beneficial. So mm-hmm. I taught him to use transliteration.
I see.
And taught him. We decided we didn't want them trying to do the same service for the Bar Mitzvah. So mm-hmm. we set up a Shacharit service and a traditional service for Neil. And Rabbi Milgram came out to preside over it. And then in the afternoon, late afternoon, we did a Mincha service. Mm-hmm. So there would be a Torah reading and that Matthew could participate in. And he was able to say certain of the blessings using transliteration. And mm-hmm. He did better than I think most people expected. So some were getting trained by parents or by mm-hmm. taking them into the cities. And that's how I also had to do that with my daughter. My daughter, who was adopted from Vietnam, she was over 13 already, but I was taking her into the cities monthly because there was a special ed program at the Talmud Torah on Sundays, Talmud Torah Minneapolis. Mm-hmm. So I took her in for that. And I then taught her, again working from transliteration because it was a little bit easier for her, how to say certain of the key prayers after me. Mm-hmm. I would stand up there with her and say Baruch Hu, and she would repeat Baruch Hu. Mm-hmm. And we got through the essentials of a bat mitzvah service that way. Mm-hmm. And by then, Yossi Gordon was our rabbi. Judy's was the first bar mitzvah that he presided over in Eau Claire.
I see.
I guess the way Judy did brought tears to a lot of people's eyes, because she was clearly very retarded, she didn't communicate a whole lot with people outside the family, mm-hmm. even though she was exposed quite a bit. And people didn't think there was much that she could do. They were surprised we hadn't institutionalized her, which we never even entertained. Mm-hmm. And Judy turned out to be the best dispositioned person in the household, and always a delight, mm-hmm. A fun girl, and she remains that way mm-hmm. to this day, even though now she's in a group home. A good opportunity in a good group home became available where she knew other residents there, and they're just mm-hmm. four women. And so she
is that here in Eau Claire?
That's right here in Eau Claire. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't even begin to think of her being in a different community because mm-hmm. she constantly needs guardianship, basically. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what parents should do if they can. And so my wife and I have been her co-guardians ever since she moved out, and that's mm-hmm. 10 years ago now.
I see.
I'm sorry, no, 8 years ago now. Mm-hmm. And so Judy had her bat mitzvah when she was about, must have been almost 16. Mm-hmm. And it was a really wonderful day. Mm-hmm. And we did the Mincha service again with Judy rather than the more full Shacharit service.
Mm-hmm. And then for all of these ceremonies, the entire community, the entire Jewish community turns out, and
yeah.
of course you invited
yes.
other friends.
The whole congregation is always invited. Mm-hmm. And yes, we did invite other friends, and the mm-hmm. synagogue was almost full on that afternoon. Mm-hmm. We brought in a caterer for the boys, too. We brought in a caterer who was a friend, actually. Mm-hmm. She doesn't live very far from here. Her husband was a teacher in the philosophy and religious studies department. She's a woman from Britain, actually, wonderful British accent. She became very adept at catering. Mm-hmm. And so she did a light lunch after the boys, after Neil's bar mitzvah, and a dessert type of thing, which was just incredible, after Matthew's bar mitzvah. Mm-hmm. And she did the same thing again as for Matthew, which she did for Judy when Judy was bar mitzvah.
Mm-hmm. Now, what I wanted to ask you, what changes occurred in the congregation during your presidency? I think you were mentioning that you began to count women.
Yeah, that was probably the most important change that succeeded. It was a traditional, while it was a conservative congregation in terms of affiliation, it was still pretty traditional. Mm-hmm. And there was a women's B'nai B'rith chapter for many years, and there was a men's B'nai B'rith chapter. When I became president, and it started becoming obvious that we weren't getting any bigger. Mm-hmm. In fact, we're beginning to decline in numbers. I basically said to people, you know, it doesn't make sense for us to try to do things as separate groups when we can have better numbers and better interactions if we combine the men and the women. We started that first with the B'nai B'rith affiliation, mm-hmm. and created a men women B'nai B'rith chapter. B'nai B'rith was not happy with that at first.
Mm-hmm.
They were still strongly divided between B'nai B'rith women and B'nai B'rith men, and it took some years before they accepted not just what we were doing, but some other congregations were doing elsewhere. And we ended up reaching a point where so few wanted to be in B'nai B'rith that we had to suspend and really discontinue the lodge up here.
Mm-hmm. Do you still belong?
No. Mm. No. There wasn't any reason that I could feel was important mm-hmm. enough to maintain a membership. I'd be a sole member up here.
Mm.
And my wife was not interested in a B'nai B'rith women's group or in that kind of activity. She mm-hmm. was into other things. And so that fell by the wayside. But yet that we had a co-ed, so to speak, chapter of B'nai B'rith for a while was, I think, part of a historical movement that was happening nationwide. I won't give us credit for having to set it in motion or anything like that.
And at one point, B'nai B'rith was voting to allow women.
Yes,
I remember
they eventually did.
Mm-hmm.
The other was with the congregation itself.
Mm-hmm.
And I had made the same point about the congregation that I think we'll be much stronger if we combine men and women, if women can come up for an aliyah. I said I did not know of any reason other than some very biased rabbinic thinking from the past for keeping women out of the service
mm-hmm.
And forcing some sort of a separation. So we began discussing having women being called up for the Torah, for an aliyah, having women do other things in connection with the service, especially counting them as part of the minyan,
mm-hmm.
and women getting a bat mitzvah that would parallel the male bar mitzvah. I proposed that kind of a change for the congregation. And it would also mean that women could be officers mm-hmm. of the congregation. And all the men supported it mm-hmm. In the congregation, and a good number of the women did. But the women, there was a group of women, about a dozen, who did not want to make that change.
Mm-hmm.
And the argument that I heard was that if we make that change, then before you know it, the women will be elected as officers.
Hmm.
They didn't want to pick up what they thought would be extra.
Were these older women who were
usually
to the old ways?
Yeah, yeah. But we still voted to make the change, and mm-hmm. of course, we were one of the first of conservative congregations to do this,
mm-hmm.
and that turned out to be a great success.
Did you receive any adverse pressure from United Synagogues about it?
Pressure to the extent that they indicated they would not want to welcome the women officers to United Synagogue kinds of events. But since each congregation had a degree of autonomy,
mm-hmm.
There wasn't a whole lot they could do.
Mm-hmm.
And eventually they themselves changed.
That's right.
I remember back in that time, and it was for as long as it lasted, it was very successful. A group of rabbinic students and other students at the Jewish Theological Seminary proposed and got granted from United Synagogue to be able to go into smaller communities for a weekend and do Shabbat programming mm-hmm. Across that weekend for small congregations. And we were able to get them out here once, sometimes twice a year. And it was fantastic.
Mm-hmm.
Here were these young people coming out with a tremendous amount of energy and desire, very friendly. They slept in different people's homes in the Jewish community. Mm-hmm. And we had a Jewish-filled Shabbat into Sunday.
Mm-hmm.
and not just the Friday night and Saturday, with these young people. And it was very good until it eventually withered away, not on our part, but the United, United Synagogue support withered away. I remember a couple of the young women, I can't remember their names anymore, but I remember a couple of the young women wanted to become rabbis. And the faculty at the seminary were debating that issue, and they voted down the idea. And it happened just before they came out, and they were just really downtrodden, they felt. They felt a rejection when they were, thought they were receiving a fair amount of encouragement. And the best they could become were certain kinds of teachers that had been reserved to men. They could teach Torah, for example, or teach, help train for bar mitzvah, but not be rabbis. And that would change after about three or four more years.
Right, I remember.
And so I guess we were indeed one of the first conservative congregations to move in that kind of direction. And we were calling women up to the Torah, and we were having women officers long before United Synagogue fully accepted the idea.
There's time for one more question and one more answer. So, how has living as a small town Jew influenced your Jewish activity and your Jewish belief?
Well, quite a bit. Growing up in New York, you don't have to do anything Jewish to feel Jewish. A quarter of the city of the metropolitan area in New York was Jewish at the time. I think those numbers have changed in more recent years, but at that time, New York was the biggest Jewish city in the world. And you felt everything around you was in part Jewish, except the Christmas decorations.
My wife.
Good to meet her. And so I felt no great need. I occasionally go to synagogue after my bar mitzvah. And for a short period of time, a group of us young fellows formed a United Synagogue group at a conservative unit that was within walking distance of my house. They had a gym, and that was the motivation at the time. But I didn't have any strong sense, but it was always latent there. I was raised in a kosher home, and, for example. And then I moved out to the University of Minnesota, and I got more interested because I was a counselor in the dorms. That was my form of financial aid in graduate school. And students, people I was their counselor for, would come up and ask me things about Judaism. And I figured I'd better learn the answers. And I started going down the hill a little more, and that's when I had initial contacts with Lou Milgram. And so I had a pretty good experience there, and the Jewish community in the cities was very welcoming of university students for things like the holidays. Then I moved out here, and in the small congregation, I was made to feel so welcome that it actually got me more deeply involved than I'd ever been. And it has pretty much stayed that way. Not deeply involved from the sense of my following all of the Jewish rituals, but a sense of identification and togetherness with the Jewish community here. That's the only thing that would have explained my staying president for 17 years.
That's right. Well, thank you very much. I enjoyed this, and this was a very important interview.
Okay, thanks. It's my pleasure. You need more of